This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Paul Alexander, and here's what's coming up.
She learned that her father died in Kenya. And somewhat conversely, although the post-independence period has had its ups and downs, the UK and Kenya have maintained some very close ties.
That's Olivia O'Sullivan, director of the UK World Programme at Chatham House, on the ties between the British royal family and Kenya, dating back to King Charles's mother becoming queen. Also, we get the latest on the conflict between Israel and Hamas, and South Africa celebrates its fourth title at the Rugby World Cup. All this and more coming up on Africa News Tonight. Britain's King Charles III begins a four-day tour of Kenya tomorrow, his first trip to Africa since becoming king following the death of his mother, Queen Elizabeth, last year. Among his objectives is addressing what Buckingham Palace officials describe as painful aspects of Britain's colonial past with the East African nation. He'll also discuss issues related to the climate crisis and the importance of national security. VOA Nairobi Bureau Chief Mariama Diallo has this story.
King Charles III and his wife, Queen Camilla, held a reception with members of the Kenyan diaspora at Buckingham Palace prior to the state visit to the East African country. This will be the third foreign trip for the royal couple since Charles became king a little more than a year ago, and their first to Africa. Kenya holds symbolic significance for Charles' family because of what it represented for his late mother. Olivia O'Sullivan, director of the UK World Programme at Chatham House.
Kenya is where the Queen's reign, Queen Elizabeth II, King Charles's mother, it's where her reign began. She learned that her father died in Kenya. And somewhat conversely, although the post-independence period has had its ups and downs, the UK and Kenya have maintained some very close ties.
Olivia O'Sullivan says there are many shared priorities between the two governments.
There are ties between their militaries. They share military training on occasion. There's more recently, the UK has kind of sought to position itself as a bit of a leader in tackling climate change, particularly the last COP, which the UK hosted in Glasgow. And Kenya, too, President Ruto in particular, has sought a leading voice and a leadership role on climate change.
King Charles and President William Ruto are expected to discuss the climate crisis, the importance of conservation efforts and working together on national security, the King's Deputy Private Secretary, Chris Fitzgerald, said earlier this month. This trip comes as the African nation celebrates 60 years of independence from Britain. Javas Bigambo is a Kenyan lawyer and a governance specialist.
If we were to look back with the benefit of retrospect, we would say that the history that's shared between Kenya and the United Kingdom in the very first part is a very violent kind of memory.
Javas Bigambo recalls Kenya's hard-fought struggle against British colonialism.
There was the issue of picking up or taking up the land of the locals when Kenya was a British protectorate from 1901. Through the time of the struggle for independence, the Mau Mau struggle, where a number of Kenyans suffered in the hands of the British.
10 years ago, Britain apologized and agreed to pay compensation to thousands of veterans of the Mau Mau nationalist uprising in Kenya, which was brutally suppressed by the British colonial government in the 1950s. The Kenya Human Rights Commission estimated that 90,000 Kenyans were killed and 160,000 detained. In Kenya, Mau Mau veterans and campaigners welcomed the apology at the time, but said the compensation of about $3,500 per victim was not enough for the pain, suffering, and long-term effects the community endured. King Charles will spend 4 days in Kenya, two in Nairobi and two in the coastal city of Mombasa. While in Nairobi, he'll meet with President Ruto, tour Uhuru Gardens and attend a banquet at the State House, among many other planned activities. Mariama Jalo, VOA News, Nairobi.
Ugandan economists have expressed confidence in the country's economy and are urging investors to ignore a U.S. government advisory about...
Countries that are home to the world's three major rainforests have agreed to cooperate to overcome deforestation and safeguard biodiversity, but fell short of a concrete alliance to protect the vital carbon sinks. The announcement came Saturday on the final day of the Three Basin Summit in the Republic of Congo. The three-day summit brought together presidents, environmental groups, technical experts, and finance sector officials to strengthen preservations of the forest in the Amazon, the Congo Basin, and Southeast Asia. The basins are home to two-thirds of the world's biodiversity, but rapid deforestation is releasing planet-warming carbon dioxide and imperiling global climate targets. It also threatens the existence of thousands of species of plants and animals. During the Brazzaville gathering, experts and policymakers discussed priorities ahead of the UN COP28 climate talks next month, including funding mechanisms to help developing countries preserve important ecosystems. A Ugandan government official says the country remains a destination for investors despite a United States warning about endemic corruption and human rights issues. Halima Athumani reports from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
Ugandan economists have expressed confidence in the country's economy and are urging investors to ignore a U.S. government advisory about risks they may face if they conduct business in Uganda. The advisor in the U.S. 2023 Investment Climate Statement warned of the financial and reputational risks posed by endemic corruption in Uganda. The statement also noted Uganda's enactment of the Anti-Homosexuality Act in May, a move condemned by LGBT advocates worldwide. Morrison Rakakamba is the chairperson of the Uganda Investment Authority, a government arm mandated with promoting investment in the country. He tells VOA that organizations such as the Oxford University Center of African Economies have ranked Uganda as one of the least risky economies on the continent. The African Development Bank's 2023 report has also ranked Uganda among the top investment destinations in East Africa. According to the Africa Development Bank, Uganda's gross domestic product is projected to grow at 6.5% in 2023 and 6.7% in 2024, assuming any global growth slowdown will be short-lived. Rakakamba says current investors are rational and know they will continue to make money in Uganda.
Investors follow money. Investors don't follow geopolitics. They don't follow, you know, culture wars that seem to be what is embedded in that advisory that you just mentioned. So we even also continue to encourage our American investors that there is money to be made in Africa, there is money to be made in Uganda. Because of the market, because of the return on investment, we are not worried about these advisories.
The Uganda Investment Authority says the country has seen exponential growth in direct foreign investment over the past 4 years from investors in United Arab Emirates, China, Germany, Japan, and the Netherlands, among others. However, Koti Paul Lakuma, a senior research fellow and head of the macroeconomics department at the Economic Policy Research Center in Kampala, says the advisory is a disadvantage for Uganda because the country still wants to attract investors. Despite investments from China, India and Europe, Lakuma points out that Uganda cannot disregard the fact that the U.S. is still the biggest social and public investor in sectors of health and education.
Like China, have you heard that they have built a school? No, they are interested more on economic infrastructure, where the returns are quick and visible. You know, they are nice for politics. Those other countries, yes, they are good and dependable, but their kind of investments are different from the investments America makes. America makes investments with long-term repayment period and return period. Not many countries are willing to take that risk.
Ruhakamba argues that even though there is corruption in Uganda, the East African country has set up online mechanisms that enable direct contact between potential investors and Ugandan officials in an effort to cut out middlemen who demand bribes. Regarding the Anti-Homosexuality Act, Uganda has experienced a political backlash for what has been described as the harshest law against the LGBT community in the world. Lakuma says there's no need for the act given other statutes on the books, and says Uganda may need to reconsider the law.
The world is becoming very sensitive. Issues of diversity, inclusivity. I think it demanded for some sensitivity from our lawmakers. We don't live in a vacuum, even though we want to keep our culture and morals. But also you must observe what is the changing world order.
In August, the World Bank said the Anti-Homosexuality Act contradicts its values. The bank said it would halt new loans to Uganda until it could test measures to prevent discrimination in Ugandan projects it finances. Halima Athmani for VA News, Kampala, Uganda.
Israel expanded its military assault deeper into the northern Gaza Strip as the United Nations and medical staff expressed fears over airstrikes hitting closer to hospitals where tens of thousands of Palestinians have sought shelter. The Hamas-run health ministry says more than 8,000 Gaza residents have died in the fighting, which began after Hamas militants assaulted communities in Israel on October 7th. In the occupied West Bank, more than 110 Palestinians have been killed in violence and Israeli raids. More than 1,400 people in Israel have been killed, most of them slain in the initial Hamas attacks. In addition, Hamas took at least 239 hostages into Gaza. The UN Security Council meets later today on Israel's ground incursion in Gaza and the humanitarian plight of Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates asked for the meeting and intends to present a resolution calling for an immediate pause in the fighting to allow more aid into Gaza. For the latest, we have reporter Linda Gradstein on the line from Jerusalem. Welcome back to Africa News Tonight, Linda.
Thank you very much.
First of all, what are the latest developments you're hearing about?
So, first of all, as you said, Israel has increased its ground incursion. Israeli tanks and troops overnight went into northern Gaza further, getting to the outskirts of Gaza City. However, this is still not the widespread ground invasion that Israeli officials have been talking about. Hamas has thousands of fighters in a network of tunnels beneath the ground. Israel says that in this overnight fighting, it killed several dozen Hamas gunmen who were hiding in buildings, and it caused, at the same time, the air campaign continued, and whole neighborhoods in northern Gaza, especially in, outside of Gaza City, have been just totally destroyed. We do have another development recently in the last couple of hours, which is that Hamas on a Hamas channel of Telegram released a video of three Israeli hostages, three women, all three of them middle-aged women, castigating the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for getting them, into the situation, saying it was his fault that they were kidnapped by Hamas, that he hasn't run the country, and saying he should do more to get them freed. The women looked healthy. Netanyahu called the video propaganda, and Israeli television channels, interestingly, have not shown the video. They've reported about the video, but Israeli officials are saying that it was clearly scripted and that it's just meant for Hamas propaganda.
The Israeli offensive into Gaza appears to be gradual instead of a single full-on invasion. What are defense officials there saying about it?
Well, the thing is that any, you know, full-on ground invasion is going to be very complicated and is going to cause a lot of life on both sides. So Israel says that it is combining a gradual ground invasion with a continual aerial bombing of all kinds of Hamas targets. Over the weekend, Israel released evidence that it's shared with, you know, intelligence services that it says shows that Hamas is using hospitals as command and control centers and have bunkers underneath all the hospitals. And as you said in the introduction, tens of thousands of Palestinians are sheltering in hospitals. The World Health Organization said that a third of the hospitals are already not functioning. One of these hospitals, the Al-Quds Hospital, received warnings from Israel that it should evacuate all of the patients and anyone sheltering there should leave, meaning that Israel is planning to bomb that hospital. That hasn't happened yet, although there have been Israeli bombings nearby, and most of the people sheltering there say they feel that they have no place to go, so they're not going to leave.
So what's the mood there in Israel now that it's 3 weeks into the conflict?
So I think the mood in Israel is, you know, people, there's been a call-up of 360,000 reservists, which is the biggest call-up in Israel's history. So there's this kind, you know, Israelis tend to be fairly patriotic. I think most Israelis agree with this goal of hitting Hamas. Large parts of the country have basically gotten back to normal. However, there are some 200,000 Israelis who've been evacuated from their houses, either communities near the Gaza border or communities near the northern border with Lebanon, where there's also been a lot of clashes, and they're staying in hotels, and they certainly have no sense of normalcy. There was a very nice little piece I saw on Facebook of a lot of people are volunteering to do the laundry of these evacuees because they're in hotels. They don't have access to washing machines. And somebody, you know, sent her friend to pick up laundry, and her friend came back with just a small bag. And she said, I could do much more than this. And the friend said, well, there's such a long line of cars that this is all they would give me. So people are actually competing to do strangers' laundry. And the Israeli reservists get a lot of support. You know, there's a lot of sort of, there's definitely this feeling of voluntarism. For example, all of the agricultural workers who were working in the fields near Gaza have left, mostly from Thai workers. And so Israeli volunteers are going to pick the produce so that it doesn't rot. I know I just saw something that, you know, a farmer from nearby there is selling his tomatoes, you know, cherry tomatoes in Israel. And he was, you know, dozens of people wrote that they want to buy tomatoes. So there's definitely, I think, a sense of voluntarism, a sense of patriotism, and a sense that, you know, after what Hamas did on October 7th, which was so barbaric and just so terrible, that people are pretty united against Hamas. The only question comes, families of the hostages. As you said, there are about 230 hostages believed to be held by Hamas, and some of them say that the ground incursion could complicate efforts to get the hostages released.
Thank you very much, Linda. That was journalist Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem. We'd like to hear your thoughts about the conflict between Israel and Hamas. Send us a text or leave a voice message by calling this WhatsApp number, +1 202 258 3076. That number again is +1 202 258 3076. Thanks. And you're listening to Voice of Africa News Tonight. I'm Paul Alexander in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all of your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Saudi Arabia says negotiations in Jeddah between Sudan's warring parties will focus on a ceasefire deal and delivery of humanitarian aid, but not on broader political issues. According to the French news agency AFP, The foreign ministry says the talks, which resumed on Thursday, aim to facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance, establish ceasefires and other confidence-building measures, and build toward a permanent cessation of hostilities. But it said the talks will not address broader political issues. The latest talks are being held in partnership with a representative of the African Union and the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, the East African Regional Bloc led by close U.S. partner Kenya. The U.S. State Department said Sunday that Sudan's civilians must be the ones to define Sudan's path going forward. Zimbabwe has natural resources that include nearly 40 different minerals and one of the world's largest deposits of diamonds. Yet, the vast majority of Zimbabweans continue to live in poverty. Columbus Mavunga visits the country's famous Marange diamond fields and talks with residents who want average people to benefit more from the country's mineral wealth.
The Marange Fields of Zimbabwe is home to one of the world's largest diamond deposits. The precious gems were first mined here in 2006. The government-owned Zimbabwe Consolidated Diamond Company says it is working to increase production so that all citizens can reap the benefits of mining the gems, according to spokesman Sugar Chagwanda.
And I'm sure we are doing this by way of making sure that we contribute to community development, be it in terms of employing locals, also infrastructure development, sport and recreation, as well as general amenities, which is quite good. And we are also extending to the province. Ultimately, the idea is to make sure that the diamonds, they benefit the entire country, which is also in sync with the vision of the government.
But the benefits have yet to reach people living nearby, says resident Atro Mshangwiza, who has lived near the Marange fields his whole life. In this diamond mining area, there is a problem, Mshangwiza says. Children are missing school because their parents are failing to pay fees. He says we hope that the diamonds can benefit the local children more through schools in the diamond mining area by reducing fees or paying their fees. That's our major concern, so the children have a great future. Zimbabwe Consolidated Diamond Company says it has started building schools with science labs to improve local children's education. But schooling isn't the only problem that Zimbabweans want diamonds to solve. They say the industry should help the economy more. The problem is that the sector lacks transparency, says Center for Natural Resource Governance Director Farai Maguru.
The diamond sector is now subject to extreme organized crime, and the leaders are the only ones who know where the diamonds are going, how the diamonds are leaving the country, where the revenues are going. But as a citizenry, we have been completely disconnected and cut out from any information regarding the diamond industry.
Getting that information would be one way to help Zimbabwe follow the example of Botswana, whose booming economy is largely built on diamonds, according to economist Prosper Chitambaram with the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe.
The second one being a beneficiation of those minerals. In other words, moving up the value chain through an industrialization-based process. So I think those two factors are important in terms of ensuring that the ordinary citizen actually gets to benefit from those resources.
Currently, Zimbabwe ranks a distant seventh in worldwide diamond production, despite having diamond fields roughly the size of Luxembourg. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Marange, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Paul Alexander in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Bandy, and our engineer, Carl Starling, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.